Hello, Jenny Murray welcoming you to Friday's edition of the Woman's Hour podcast. Good morning. A new film, The Diary of a Teenage Girl, has caused quite a controversy. The filmmakers wanted it classified 15, but it's only open to 18-year-olds. Should 15-year-olds be able to see a girl of their own age having sex and taking drugs? The late love affair between Joy Davidman and C.S. Lewis was portrayed in Shadowlands. But what was the story of Joy's life before she met him? In the next in our series on men and relationships, we meet Marley. His father was absent from his childhood. How has he managed his own children? And it's the height of the camping season. Where's the romance in a tent in the rain? Now, breastfeeding has hit the headlines yet again, and this time the scandal is the woman who posted a picture of herself on Facebook with a toddler on each breast. One of them was her own 16-month-old son. The other was the 18-month-old son of her friend. She took care of him whilst her friend was at work, and her friend was apparently grateful that she was prepared to feed him breast milk. Nor, it seems, is it unusual. Jenny contacted us to say she fed her sister's baby while her sister was at college.
At the time, I was living with my mum and dad up in Wales because I was a single mum. My son was about 2 years old and my sister went back to college to do her PGCSE. So my mum and I looked after the baby, and I think he was probably about 6 or 7 months when she went back to college. It just seemed a kind of a really obvious thing to do. He was quite distressed because he was still young, and I had my son who I was still feeding, and I had it at my disposal to do, and it just seemed crazy not to. So it was never really an issue. It was never anything we discussed. It was just something that happened organically.
Why has something that's long been common practice, known as wet nursing, caused such shock and horror? Amy Lysons is an historian and the author of Royal Babies, A History Since 1066 to 2013. Christina Hardiment is a social historian. Christina, why do you reckon it would have caused such shock now?
I think the background is how much modern advice on babies concentrates on this extraordinarily exclusive bond between the breastfeeding mother and the baby. And that is fine if everything goes well, but as in the case you quote, where the mother is absent and so on, it does seem completely natural, as they said, to do it. But it isn't familiar to us. It's part of unwritten history, which I'm always interested in because they're the people who are doing things but don't write them down. Nowadays, of course, it's so easy to put stuff up on social media. We're uncovering all sorts of things.
How normal in the past would it have been to have a wet nurse?
Well, the change is when it became unusual to have a wet nurse. From earliest times, unwritten history, it would be natural for mothers to, if they couldn't feed, to find someone else to feed their baby, because it's undoubtedly the safest alternative to breast milk in undeveloped places. And indeed, today in the undeveloped places, it's a perfectly normal thing. There is a sort of different categories of wet nursing. One is the one between friends, which is to oblige. The other is when it becomes a commercial activity, and that's when perhaps I think certainly in the manuals of the 18th and 19th century they began to hesitate and say, who are these women who are making money from breastfeeding, perhaps abandoning their own children in the process, and are they suitable? Will their characteristics be absorbed by our children? And questions then began to be raised. But it was still, until the very late, to the last quarter of the 19th century, easily the best alternative for babies.
Amy, it was common practice for royal babies. Why?
I think there's a lot of issues here, and we're looking at the history of breastfeeding alongside that of wet nursing. But for a queen in particular, she's looking to get back to her duties. She wants her fertility to be restored, and the contraceptive benefits that breastfeeding can give for 9 months or a year, and I hesitate to say interference and encumbrance, but a queen would be sort of out of the royal business if she was committed to breastfeeding every couple of hours. So a royal baby in particular, and aristocratic children, were given to usually a group of three or four women who were very carefully chosen. They really did believe that whatever qualities this woman might have would be absorbed in the breast milk. So they were very carefully judged, but usually on appearance. We've got an example in the 1600s, a Swiss physician suggests that wealthy families employ a range of women and their milk is checked to see that it's sweet and white and that they have rosy cheeks and they look otherwise healthy.
So to what extent, Amy, was it always a class issue that a higher class or wealthy woman would hire a less well-off one to do it for her?
Very much so. I think that there was must have been a pool of these available women, but they weren't necessarily lower class themselves. There does seem to be examples. I think of Mary Queen of Scots as well, who drew from her pool of her own waiting women to feed her infant son. But I don't think it was exclusively upper class. I think we mustn't underestimate the ease of breastfeeding in terms of supply, and obviously it's free to do that. And if you are lower down the social scale and you have a child to feed, it would make sense for you to look for someone to help you do that, because we mustn't also forget that breastfeeding, as Christina mentioned, can be difficult for some women. Some women just aren't able to do it for whatever reason, either physically or work commitments. So I think the upper class examples are very well recorded. We know about those. But lower down the social scale, there must have been a lot of informal, as the example of the lady you quoted at the beginning of the programme, a lot of informal exchanging of babies went on, particularly when mothers were weak or were ill.
How, Christina, would the relationship between the wet nurse and the mother work?
Well, it was very variable. There were some wet nurses where it was very problematic because the baby was thriving, but the wet nurse regularly got drunk. Mind you, they were told they should drink a certain amount of porter in order to improve the quality of their milk. But very often the wet nurse moved on to become the child's nanny and became a permanent member of the family. There's a great many examples of that. And the bond, there's another interesting bond between the not only the wet nurse nanny and the child, but if the wet nurse had their own baby to feed, this idea of the milk sibling or milk kin is cross-culturally quite a widespread phenomenon, where you have a rather special relationship with that child whose mother's milk you shared.
Yeah, there's an example.
Amy, yeah. I think by Elizabethan times, wet nurses had a reputation for carelessness. Why did that develop during that period?
That's an interesting one. I think when we get to this point, we're looking at quite a different relationship between children and parents. It was quite common for, and we talk about the bond, but I think it was quite common for children to be sent out to different families. And a child might be sent out to a wet nurse for a year. The diary of John Dee gives us examples of this, of their children being sent from one wet nurse to the other. And there are lots of occasions when John Dee's wet nurses were ill or were considered to be unsuitable, and so they had to put the baby into a carriage and rush it across London to find someone else suitable. It's difficult to say exactly, you know, why it became a cause for suspicion at that point. Something changed in the zeitgeist in terms of parenting, possibly.
I think it was also a redefinition with the growth of the city, because cities were plague-ridden and were dangerous for children. And it was very often thought a much better idea to send the baby out to the country to a wet nurse for the sake of survival. Hester Thrale, Dr. Johnson's friend, her book on children said, oh, they sent this small child, she used to call the crab, away to a wet nurse and returned 2 years later, much improved.
Christina, there was a Netmoms survey which revealed that 1 in 25 mothers said they have breastfed another woman's baby. How likely is it ever to become common again?
I don't know that it will become common again, because there are 75% who obviously said they wouldn't breastfeed another woman's baby. But I think it shows the general toleration and the interest and the new affection. I say it's new because there used to be a kind of competitive spirit among mothers when I was young. And now there seems to be such closeness and talking and sites like Mumsnet and really getting my daughters all get together with their friends and their babies. And I think it's very heartwarming. And I'm sure groups like that, who were in a perhaps class together, if somebody got stuck, would do that sort of thing.
Christina Hardiment and Amy Lysons, thank you both very much indeed. You may be aware of a film which is showing in cinemas at the moment and has caused quite a controversy. It's called The Diary of a Teenage Girl, and it's about Minnie, who's 15, growing up in San Francisco in the 1970s with her mother and her younger sister. Her mother has a boyfriend, Munro, who's 35. Minnie fancies him, flirts with him, and ends up having a sexual relationship with him. The sex is graphic, including a scene where she and a friend fellate two boys in the loo in a bar, and she takes drugs with Munro. Well, the filmmakers wanted a 15 certificate saying girls of that age should be able to see that it's not unusual to have an interest in sex at that age. The British Board of Film Classification insisted on an 18 certificate. Who was right? Alice Vincent writes about arts and entertainment for the Daily Telegraph. Karen Krasanovich writes about film. Which way would she go? 15?
I would go 15.
Why?
I think it's important for young women who are coming into their sexuality or maybe have already achieved it, legal or not, to understand that it doesn't necessarily mean the end of their choices in their life. And also to see that men are not always the answer. Sex is fine, but you don't have to tie men or relationships in with that. You can have sex and you can move on.
Alice, which way would you go?
I think the rating is fair. I think 18 is fair.
Why?
Because firstly, I think the rating isn't just about sex. I think that's what everyone's focusing on, but there's also a lot of drug use. I think the fact that she's taken her mother's boyfriend is a very complex and adult issue. And with regards to the sex, some 15-year-olds will have that level of confidence and assurance about their sexuality, and it would be great for them, but I think there are just as many 15-year-olds who aren't and would be very confused.
And surely, Karen, what we're seeing is an abusive relationship. A 15-year-old may fancy a 35-year-old man, but he has no business pursuing it.
Well, that's true. He does not have. But he doesn't actually pursue her. They sort of go in parallel, and that's because he's actually not very bright. Sometimes the adults, and this is the same thing I think in Fish Tank and other films, that the adults are not as mature as the children.
But doesn't that rather portray her as a Lolita-type figure, which we've been trying to throw away, you know?
No.
Young girls do not necessarily seduce older men.
Lolita's very, very different. Lolita is, we may see her as this power player or whatever, but we're seeing that from Humbert Humbert's viewpoint. We're not seeing it from hers. This is from a young girl who, if she was 21, we wouldn't be having problems with this. She's just matured faster in an environment that's a scary environment. There are a lot of boys and girls that in the environment that that this girl has been raised in would sink, would end up in care or something. She doesn't. She shows that despite the mistakes, and she makes many, she can survive and she succeeds.
To what extent, Alice, for you, does the film fail, regardless of the age of the viewer, in not condemning the older man?
I'm not sure that it does fail, because I think what is really important about this film and why we don't see him demonised is because we see it purely from the protagonist's point of view. So we see it purely from the view of a 15-year-old girl. And, you know, she scorns him by saying, oh, he's just a dirty old man or something. But she's clearly not aware of the morality, because if she was, she wouldn't be going there. And I think that's what one of the most important things about it is, it's, we don't get that adult judgment. We just see it from her point of view. It's her journey.
What dilemmas, Karen, do you suppose the board faced in dealing with underage sex in a film aimed at teenagers? After all, it is illegal.
Yes, well, I am pro-censorship. I want to say that. I go to the BBFC lunches and they show us what they take out, so I understand the job they do and I know how difficult it is. They have a particular set of, you know, sexual references and also swearing references and also moral situations that they follow for ratings. And this is how they've come up with this kind of rating. It was given an R rating in the States, which means that an adult can take their child to see it, which I think is the right rating.
Fish Tank did have a similar theme, Karen. It was about a teenage girl and an adult male, and that was rated 15. How was that film different from this one?
I think that Fish Tank was considered somehow more in the realm of what we've seen before, which is she is actually in an abusive relationship with him, but she feels very hurt by him, and also she is not in control. But the difference between Minnie and the girl in Fish Tank is that Minnie is actually in control. And don't forget, she also says when she sees Patty Hearst, you know, how could you fall in love with your captors? I mean, this is a young woman who actually has a moral sense.
How much tension has there been over the years about what teenagers should be allowed to see? I have to confess that I did sneak in to James Bond that was rated A. I think that was, 15? And I was 12 and I got in. Why would they have made James Bond unseeable for a little girl?
Well, that's a very good question. I'm assuming it's the violence, one thing. Also, the skimpy outfits, possibly. I don't think James Bond's have any sex as such. I would say it's probably the violence and maybe sexual situations.
And other films where there's been tension about it?
Well, there's a long list of films that have questionable ratings, particularly the NC-17 films in the States. And here, where some of the horror films actually have reasonable ratings. So it just depends on what the film contains. For me, okay, I'm not a parent. I can understand that drug use and swearing would be a concern for me. But sex, I think if it's in the situation where there is no victimization, which I don't think is the case. Well, actually, there is no victimization in Diary of a Teenage Girl. I would feel very happy for my young siblings to go and see it.
We do have to make clear, don't we, that this film is about an illegal relationship. She is only 15.
Absolutely. It is illegal for a 15-year-old to have sex with a 35-year-old. And in California, it is illegal for teens to have sex with anybody that is 3 years older than they are.
Absolutely. I mean, it's 16 in the UK. But I think the other thing to note here is that the average age of women losing their virginity in the UK is 17 as well. So it's not only illegal, but it's also quite unusual and against the norm.
Generally, Alice, how often do we see a film which suggests it's okay for a woman to make her own choices about her sexual behaviour without being condemned for it?
Sadly, not often enough, I think. That is one of Diary of a Teenage Girl's strengths. And I'm not condemning that at all. I thought it was completely wonderful. And even had I seen it as 16 or 17, I think it would have been very important. But the thing is, as you say, you snuck into a 15. What if mm-hmm. I don't feel comfortable with 13, 14-year-olds going and seeing this film, potentially. Mm-hmm. There should be more films where women have sexual agency, even young women. I think there should be more films when older women have sexual agency. We're constantly shown as being dangled on the end of a string controlled by a man when it comes to sexual relationships in films.
Yeah. If we think about Betty Blue, for example, I mean, she had sexual agency, but then she had to go crazy. There's always some price to pay.
Yeah.
If a woman has sexual agency and doesn't end up in a relationship with a man being controlled by a man, she is usually marginalized.
I think another interesting film that's out this week, today in fact, is Trainwreck. And there's a very interesting narrative there where Amy Schumer, who is brilliant in it, has this crazy life, sleeps with whoever she wants, she acts, you know, like a man, has one-night stands, but her life is made better and she is happier when she's in a nice, solid relationship. I think that spells it all out, really.
Just going back to the classification and this question of girls sneaking in, isn't it actually better to have it at 18, Karen, so that the 16, 17-year-olds may well sneak in, but the 14, 15-year-olds won't?
I was thinking about that. I think that there is a level of awareness and maturity where this film is going to be repugnant to a certain level of teens. They're going to go, ugh, I don't get this. It makes me feel creepy. I want to go. I mean, I've snuck in the movies as well. Or also, I've just waited until they're available and then see them when nobody's watching. I think if you're mature enough, you will get to see this film. And I think in this way, I think the 18 rating by the BBFC has actually made it more alluring to those under 18.
I was talking to Karen Krasanovich and Alice Vincent. Still to come in today's programme, the next in our series on men and relationships, Marley had an absent father and then became one. And at the height of the camping season, where's the romance? In a tent in the rain. Now, you may well be familiar with Shadowlands, the story of the late great love affair between C.S. Lewis and the American poet Joy Davidman. In the late 80s, they were played in the theatre by Nigel Hawthorne and Joan Lapaterre. In the 1993 film, it was Anthony Hopkins and Deborah Winger. And whichever one you saw, you will have needed a pocket full of tissues as Joy died from cancer at the age of only 45. A new book, Joy, Poet, Seeker, and the Woman Who Captivated C.S. Lewis, tells the full story of her life. The author, Abigail Santa Maria, told me what prompted her fascination with Joy.
I was originally interested in Joy Davidman through reading the works of C.S. Lewis. I had read Problem of Pain and Mere Christianity, two of his adult nonfiction books. In those books, he talks about faith in a way that's very logical and rational and intellectual, but extremely wise and insightful. I had been recently involved in the recovery effort after September 11th. And what I was really looking for was some wisdom and insight into pain and grief, where God is during tragedies. And so I turned to another Lewis book called A Grief Observed, and I found a very different C.S. Lewis. All of the stoicism was gone, and he was completely shaken by the loss of his wife. He was devastated. He was shaking his fist at God. He had written it in the months after her death. And the way that he talks about her mind and her heart and their physical relationship and their emotional relationship and intellectual relationship and conversations was mind-blowing and stunning. I wanted to know more about who this woman was who could have such an impact on him.
But why did you want to tell her story when so much of her seemed to be known through Shadowland?
Well, Shadowlands actually only covers the last few years of her life. And what I learned after reading A Grief Observed and doing a basic search on her was that she was a New Yorker. C.S. Lewis, of course, was an Oxford Don. She was Jewish born, raised in the Bronx, and had a whole fascinating, successful life as a poet and a film critic in New York City on the leftist literary scene of the 1930s and 40s, long before she ever met and married C.S. Lewis. And I am a New Yorker, and I was in New York City. I was working on my master's thesis at Columbia University, and I learned that Joy had been a student at Columbia University and had also gotten her master's degree at Columbia. And I realized that I was literally walking on the same physical ground that she had walked on. And there's this weird kind of, you know, connection there. And I was in the library working on my master's thesis at the same time I was learning about her. I knew that to fulfill my degree requirements, I was required to deposit a copy of my master's thesis with the library. And I thought, I wonder if that policy stood in 1935 when Joy was a student and getting her master's degree. So I just walked over to the reference desk and I asked the reference librarian, and she typed Joy's name into the computer and up popped her thesis. It was archived in an offsite annex, and I filled out a call slip. And 2 days later, the librarian brought me this typed manuscript that Joy had typed and deposited herself some 70 years before. And as far as I could tell, nobody had ever thought to look for it. Once I saw that, I thought, what else might be all around me in terms of people, letters, other documents? And it turned out quite a lot.
Now, she married Bill Gresham, who I think is generally painted as a difficult man, a raging alcoholic. What actually was he really like?
He was a raging alcoholic, although for the last few years of her marriage to him, he was largely sober. He was in AA, but he had fought in the Spanish Civil War, and that experience caused him what we would be today, he would probably be diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. So he was a troubled man, certainly, but he was also extremely charismatic and enigmatic. He was well-loved, and he was also a very good writer.
Now, they had two sons. What impact did her family life have on her career as a writer?
Well, Joy got married late for those days. She was 27 when she got married the first time. She thought she might never get married, but she built a tremendous career in her 20s and then became an award-winning poet and went to Hollywood and wrote screenplays for MGM for 6 months, came back to New York, and armed with the knowledge from Hollywood, became a film critic for the communist magazine, The New Masses. She wrote pieces about really scoffing at women who gave up careers for marriage and motherhood. And she was, Joy was really part of the first generation, at least in America, of women who could form opinions, set goals, and achieve them career-wise without the full permission of their husbands and fathers. And it was tremendous, Joy, what Joy built for herself in the 30s as a single woman. And when she got married, they moved out of New York City and moved into the suburbs, as many people still do today. And she found that she could not, she didn't have the resources to make it possible for her to have a career and a family at the same time as a woman in the early 1940s.
How did the relationship with Lewis actually start?
She began studying religions after she, as an atheist, had an experience where she was in crisis and she found herself on her knees praying. And she said, wait a second, I'm an atheist. I don't believe in God. Why am I praying? So she began studying religions and she came to Lewis and she came to Christianity through Lewis. And then she began writing to him letters for kind of spiritual guidance. And Lewis responded to every letter that he received. And a pen friendship grew out of her initial letter and became a vigorous correspondence.
And what drew them together into... It was a grand passion.
It's a great love story. Joy's marriage to Bill Gresham was disintegrating. Lewis, for his part, considered Joy a great pen friend and nothing more. But Joy began to fall in love with Lewis through his letters. And one of the greatest finds of my research was a collection of love sonnets that Joy wrote for C.S. Lewis, which she meticulously dated and cataloged and put together, beginning when she was in America, still married to her first husband, before she ever even met Lewis face to face. And then Joy felt she needed to meet him. She left her two sons and Bill for 5 months and went to England and met Lewis and spent time with him in his home. When she went home, Bill, her husband, had fallen in love with her cousin, which I think that she suspected may happen if she went away. Divorce laws in New York State were such that in order to get a divorce, you had to prove adultery. Joy then took the boys and moved back to England, writing sonnets all the way through all of this, love sonnets for Lewis, in which she hints that she proclaimed her love to him and he rebuffed her and sent her away. And I think that part of the mythology that you referred to earlier about Bill Gresham being this violent, raging monster came because Joy, to win back C.S. Lewis's sympathy, wrote to him telling him, you know, that Bill was beating her and throwing her around and that he was this horrible person. And everybody since then has seen those particular letters and taken Joy's word at face value without looking at the complexities of any breakdown of any marriage. Everybody who I've spoken to, who lived with them in the house at the time, who lived with him before and after, never saw him be violent towards another human being.
I know that one of her sons, Douglas, particularly, was helpful to you with your research, and you knew them both. How did they look back on Lewis? Because he, of course, looked after them after Joy died.
Both of Joy's sons, Douglas and David, had nothing but wonderful things to say about their stepfather. He was supportive of both of them, even though they were vastly different types of people. Even after Joy died, her older son, David, went back to Judaism, wanted to explore Judaism, and became an Orthodox Jew for a while. And Lewis even connected him with a rabbi in Oxford to study with. So he was supportive of them. He loved them, and they loved him back. And he was a wonderful, wonderful father to them.
Abigail Santa Maria, and the book is called Joy, Poet, Seeker, and the Woman Who Captivated C.S. Lewis. And so to the next in our series of men's experience of family, fatherhood and relationships. This week, we've been hearing from fathers, and today it's the turn of Marley. He's 41 and from London. He's a father and a stepfather with a close relationship with his daughter, but has lost contact with his sons from his first marriage. His own father was absent when he was growing up, and he was driven to join the Black Fathers Support Group. He began by describing his childhood to the Times relationship counsellor, Susie Godson.
Growing up with two older sisters and my mum, I was always looking for a male role model, you know, someone that I could look to and say, okay, well, this is how being a man looks like and this is how you're supposed to act and behave. Those are the people that I'd look to were people on the TV or people in the church. It was always kind of by proxy or something else. So a lot of my youth, you know, actually getting up to my 30s, still trying to just figure this thing called being a grown-up looks like.
You became a young dad yourself. Mm. Can you tell me a little bit about that experience?
We were married, myself and my ex-wife now. You know, we had a beautiful boy and things were okay. You know, they weren't perfect, but, you know, we were working together. my ex-wife, she was at the time learning to be an accountant. And so the decision was made between the two of us that I should stay home with the baby, which was really cool because me and this little boy became best mates. And I don't want to pretend to be a mum being a dad. I wanted to be a dad being a dad. So, you know, as he was growing up, you know, we'd just go out for a walk, for example. I'd put the carry-on on my front. And then, we'll just go out for a walk and you know, go to the park. I'd show him butterflies. I'd show him, you know, squirrels. He has no idea what I'm talking about. He's falling asleep. But we had a great bond, the two of us. And, then his brother came along. And a little bit after that, then me and their mum split. And that was very difficult because of my growing up without a dad. I knew the impact on those boys not having me around. We spent 7 years going back and forth to court for me to have access to these two boys. Without going into the details, it never worked out.
And do you have a relationship with the boys?
No, I haven't seen them in over 10 years now. It feels like you're in constant mourning. It feels like you never get to the point where you say, okay, well, you know, when my mum passed away, you know, you spend the time of mourning and then you go, okay, well, she's laid to rest, she hasn't got anything to worry about. But for me, I know that he's out there. I know that he's going through the same angst that I went through with me not being there. And so it feels like as though you're always in that stage of mourning. Even if you laugh and you find something funny, it's never 100% funny because there's a part of you that just can't be fully engaged with that because there's a part of you out there. And how does my not being there impact their view of the world? So
you're a member of the Black Fathers support group.
Yeah.
How important has it been for you to be able to talk to other men about the challenges of being a father?
Oh, it's been a lifeline. It's interesting because, you know, in a typical fathers group, we have a check-in and it's supposed to be a 2-minute check-in. So you go around and one person say, oh, things are fine, went to work, you know, things are fine, kids are crazy, wife's getting on my nerves, but I'm good. And it would go like that. And then someone would say something like, I lost my job today. And then everything would stop. And we'd then get into that conversation about how it impacts him personally, but then how that impacts his family and how he feels where his place is in the family and how he thinks that his family now view him because now he's lost that place in the family. And at the end of every group, we stand up and we hold hands. So it goes left over right. And we'll just take a minute silence. And then one person would say something, for us to sort of go forth and be good dads for that week kind of thing, right? And the reason why I mention that is because in that minute silence, it is the best minute of the week for me. I love it. Just that minute where I just stop and just have a minute silence for myself and for the job that I have as being a dad and, you know, the job I have as being a useful member of the group and as a citizen and as a black man. And I did a Google search on black father and all I saw was black father, missing father. So my mum is my father. I saw just negative connotations around black fathers. Just the one thing I would say about it is that, you know, I remember a lady called up and said, well, look, what if dad is just a negative influence on the child? And as a loving mother, I've got to protect him from that. And I said, okay, so what is he doing negative? And she said, well, he's just horrible. Okay, so what's he doing that's horrible? So she said, well, he just comes in and he's just not engaging. And I was like, that's pretty much every other man. That's just kind of like, you know, that just comes with the territory, right? And if you thought that he would have been a bad father, then maybe you shouldn't have had a child with him. But now that the child is here and he's here, you taking that away from your child, that's unforgivable, you know? But we're in a time where the rule book has been torn up. And so now the idea of being a dad isn't imperative. It's not important even. It's a choice. And for some women, they choose not to have dad around. And for some dads, they choose not to be around. So, yeah, I think that's just another outcome of us moving away from those traditional rules that we had set by our parents and grandparents.
So you're a stepdad now.
I am a stepdad, yeah, to a great 22-year-old mountain of a man, and he's now moved out And what was great about it, he said to me, why are you so nice to me? Because he was trying to figure out where the trick was in me being willing to help out and give advice and so on and so forth. And I said to him, I told him about my two boys. And I said, you are like a tonic. You keep me sane, you know. All that love that I don't get to give them, you get it. So it's good for you, it's good for me. We're good for each other, because that's kind of like how it is now, yeah.
Marley was talking to Susie Godson, and you can find details about the Black Fathers Support Group on the Woman's Hour website. Now, I have to say, I pity anybody who thought going on a camping holiday this week was a good idea. I remember only too well the misery of being washed out at guide camp as a teenager and having to go home in wet clothes because we couldn't keep anything dry. But still, the idea of a camping holiday has a certain romance about it. Sitting around a campfire, singing songs, snuggling up together in a cosy sleeping bag, waking in the morning to a fresh and sunny dawn, etc., etc. But is its romantic reputation inevitably a washout? Well, Matthew de Betois is the author of The Art of Camping, and Nell Frizzell is a writer and journalist. Nell, why have you decided camping is not as romantic as one might imagine?
I think camping absolutely has the potential to be romantic. It can be a recipe for romance. It can also be a recipe for cystitis. And proximity with someone hunched over like a prawn, dousing themselves in a wet wipe while it rains outside and you are desperately trying to find something that you can cook on a one-ringed stove. So it can be lovely, it can be charming, it can be pastoral, it can get you close to nature, but it can also get you too close to someone else's undercarriage.
Matthew, what's your experience of camping and romance?
We see, I agree that, you know, it could go wrong, but that's what gives it its intensity, you know, that's what gives it its potential. It's always, you know, historically been related to freedom, I suppose. You know, in the late 19th century, when this may sound slightly lateral, but, you know, when rubber was invented, it allowed people to take bicycles out, you know, the rubberized bicycle wheel, at the same time as the prophylactic. And so these people would ride on the bikes out to go camping, and it was an image of sexual liberation and freedom. And that's what
and
I
And a ground
about
sheet,
it.
So you didn't get too wet.
And a rubberized ground sheet, in case you did have a recipe for cystitis. It's not a recipe I'm ever going to put in my book.
You did go with your wife soon after you met, didn't you?
We did, a few months after we first met. And yes, a sort of summer of camping and travelling together. But I took the precaution, this will make me sound like a very pragmatic young man, I took the precaution of taking two small tents.
That's chivalry. That's not romance. That's straight-up chivalry.
Now, why did that make a difference? Did she have to pitch her own tent,
no,
or did
no,
you
no,
pitch
no,
it for
no,
her?
No. I mean, they were very simple to pitch. She's a very capable camper and will chastise me if I suggest that I was leading this in a masculine way. She was very absolutely into it. The theory was just that moment of personal space over a three-week young romance. That's what I was going for.
What can you learn, Nell, from camping? If you're, let's say, testing out a new relationship and you go on a camping holiday, what do you learn about the other person?
I think I hold a record for the early onset of camping. I've taken people camping on a second date, which is arguably too soon. And so then you learn all sorts of things about them, namely how they look pulling on a pair of thermal socks with a headlight on and not very much else. You learn how good they are at lighting a fire in the rain. I mean, I understand there is a certain romance to those gender roles that sometimes play out in camping, or there's a romance to the domesticity that you're sort of pretending at playing house, you're pretending you're pioneers. But it's about as sexy as a limp piece of paraffin smelling bacon shared over a dung strewn piece of tarpaulin, which is often what you end up doing. I think you learn how they cope in a crisis. You learn how comfortable they are with someone else's body and dirt, and also how much of an exhibitionist they are, because there is something quite odd about a campsite as opposed to wild camping or festival camping or a camping wedding, which is something that I've been on a few times, which is how happy they are to pretend that you're in an insulated, a sound insulated space, whereas actually you're in a four-poled catacomb of cheese-smelling claustrophobia and everyone can hear exactly what's happening.
How do you deal, Matthew, with the misery of a leaky tent? Because, you know, so often it rains. Or or the overheating in a tent should the sun happen to shine?
It depends on your tent. I mean, I accept Nell's point that tents afford no auditory privacy. Yeah, and you know, precautions have to be taken accordingly, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. You did find out, you know, if people had unfortunate exhibition tendencies. Mm. So you could say that camping allows you to cut to the chase in terms of romance. Tents don't leak as much as they used to. Some tents, I until recently owned a beautiful tent that had lots of fantastic ventilation in. Bigger problem for me is the wind. Rather than the rain.
Tent tends to blow away.
Yeah, and particularly I foolishly camped on a cliff overlooking a beautiful beach, Beth Leven Beach in Cornwall. It's amazing. But yeah, and my tent has aluminium poles and they were snapped in half. That was only last week. So I'm still recovering from the trauma of that.
Is it better to go, you're going to kill me for saying this, to go glamping? You know, go to a posh campsite and stay in a posh tent?
I think I've softened my stance on glamping. I'm no longer the hardcore camper because if you want to go away over a weekend, and particularly if you, I live in London now, it's very difficult to get out of London at all by car over a weekend. So going somewhere where everyone's already pitched it and it's going to take care of it means it's great. You can do it for a weekend. And also particularly camping requires a lot of physical you know, aptitude. And if you don't feel up to it at that point, it is also a great way you can go into the countryside without having to go through all the rigmarole of putting the tent up. So I've softened my stance on it.
How soft are you on glamping?
I've never really done glamping. All of my family holidays were camping, hardcore camping. If someone got ill, they got ill in a tent. If someone got lost, they had to find the tent, all of those things. But I will say that a blow-up inflatable double mattress and a duvet rather than a sleeping bag, I will give that nod to glamping. They are significantly nicer. But in terms of yurts at festivals and sheds and all of the cabins in the woods and things, I think they are possibly more comfortable. Are they more romantic? Maybe not, because you're still going to have to traipse across a field in the middle of the night to try and wash your hands.
And they are expensive, aren't they?
They're much more expensive, yeah. I suppose one of the reasons why I take men who I don't necessarily know well enough camping is because neither of us have the money to go to a hotel or on city break or houses big enough to sort of have a party there. So we go camping instead.
Matthew de Beytois and Nell Frizzell on Romance Under Canvas. On breastfeeding other people's babies, Roxana emailed, "In the 1930s, my mother breastfed my cousin because his own mother developed mastitis and couldn't feed him. My own brother was 6 months older than my cousin and my mother breastfed both boys. This wasn't considered to be odd or unusual and we were always closer to him than to his siblings. He was, after all, our milk brother." Roz says, "My sister's mother-in-law breastfed other women's babies in Palermo in Sicily at the end of World War II. As many women were starving and couldn't produce milk, but she had milk to spare. And after feeding her baby, Stefano, she fed as many as she could." Clive says, "Michelangelo was breastfed by a stonemason's wife. And it was said at the time that it set him on the course of the great marble carver of Florence." The other question we asked today was, should 15-year-olds be able to see a girl of their own age having sex and taking drugs at the new film, The Diary of a Teenage Girl? Sue tweeted, "I took my 17-year-old daughter to watch it and thought it was brilliant. No regrets, but wouldn't have taken her at 15. Jane emailed, "Am I the only mother of teenage girls in the UK who is horrified at the thought of my 15-year-old daughter watching a film that tells her that it's normal behaviour to have sex with an adult and equally liberating to give fellatio to teenage boys in a toilet? What is sexually liberating about this? What kind of society does the contributor want for our daughters? Not one I want." And finally, Phyllis emailed, "I'm in my late 50s and I went to see it. I was the only woman amongst four old men sitting each on their own. The teenage audience that this film was aimed at would have been able to get into Mission Impossible, totally unrealistic, hyped up violence. Diary of a Teenage Girl was realistic and relevant to that age group. I asked the folk at the cinema desk if this had been the norm. Yes, they said, the majority of the audience that week had been old or middle-aged men. Wrong rating." And then on the subject of camping, Kengo tweets, "If you can't be romantic in a tent, you can't anywhere. So give the relationship up." And then Alan writes, I was recently camping on the Sillies and the local bus driver was so engrossed in a Woman's Hour programme, he missed three stops. I think it was the 10:45 book about the man having a sexuality crisis. Very funny reactions from the people on the bus. Tomorrow in Weekend Woman's Hour with Jane, three women judges tell us what life is like in the world of the judiciary. And you can hear the singer-songwriter Buffy St. Marie. Join Jane tomorrow, 4 o'clock. Bye-bye.